Welcome to The Blurg. This is the second part of a discussion about worrying Apple trends. In the previous episode, Russell Ivanovich and I broke down many of the warts we both have observed creeping into Apple's products and some of the what we saw as questionable decisions around some of Apple's product lines of late. In that episode, I mentioned I'd love to have a similar discussion with someone who might be able to offer a bit more defense for some of these moves by Apple. And I'm immensely excited that renowned Apple analyst and editor-in-chief of iMore, Renee Ritchie, has agreed to do just that. So, Renee, thanks for coming on and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I really enjoyed the show with Ivan, even though his accent is blatantly fake.
Yes, that's definitely true with Russell.
Sorry, Russell. I could call, I'm so terrible at names.
Yeah. Okay, so I listened back to the episode recently, and I think there's a few sort of logical groups with a lot of the things that Russell and I were talking about. So I've broken those out, so let's run through it in that order. I think certainly the first thing to start on that I'd be interested in your opinion on is where you see the whole ecosystem sitting as far as bugs.
Yeah, so just one thing I wanted to say is that instead of a defense of Apple, because I think that most of the stuff is indefensible, but the idea is that there are reasons for a lot of things, and we'll get into all of those, including mythical man months and all sorts of things. So what I'd like to do is just maybe provide a different opinion and some explanation for why I think some things happen and why some choices are made rather than others.
Sure. Sounds great.
So bugs are something I find really interesting. So when Marco did that famous a functional high ground article, the first thing I did was go and look at message boards like discussions.apple.com and the forums at iMore and the just the Mac Rumors forums to get a sense of it, because one of the problems we have with humans is that our brains are terrible. They're terrible, terrible creations because they are very of the now. We have a very low tolerance for current pain and almost no memory of past pain. So things that we wanted to throw across the room a year ago, we don't even remember anymore. And something that's relatively minor but is stopping us from working right now is the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
And when you look back at the history of bugs, every year we hear the same thing. The bugs are worse. The bugs are terrible. Why are there so many bugs? And then I go back and look at last year and the bugs are bad. The bugs are terrible. Apple's getting worse. 3 years ago, the bugs are terrible. The bugs are bad. Apple's getting worse. And it's a consistent pattern year after year after year. I mean, like things like Core Audio, I used to want to take my laptop and chuck it because Core Audio would just shred my universe every couple of weeks. And there's just a long list. The iPhone, I think it was the iPhone 3G, its first version shipped with an amazingly bad bug on 3G. Like it couldn't work on a lot of 3G networks and they had to rush out a fix for it. So I think it's not mythical, and I don't want to say that our feelings are incorrect. I just want to say that in terms of bugs, they always, always happen. And over time, we forget the bugs that bugged us last year and we suffer under the ones bugging us now. So they always seem more visceral and more palpable. And when you have a huge change like iOS 7, it makes almost like a bookmark. And you can say, oh, this is when a bunch of things change. Therefore, I remember this and this was particularly bad. And resprings, of course, are highly visual. Springboard crashes are highly visual. So they make a huge impression. But I don't think just of Apple, but of all companies, is there are just always bugs. And the severity of them is what fluctuates, maybe.
I don't think there can be any argument that bugs are absolutely an issue with modern-day software. And I think you could also make the case that one of the reasons that we're complaining more is because as each year go by, we're spending more and more time with, you know, certainly our phones and technology in general. So if you only get a bug every X minutes, if you're spending more minutes every day, then you're going to experience more bugs. But the one thing I would say to that, certainly as far as Apple is concerned, I personally hold Apple to a higher standard here simply because Apple control everything. Now, on Android, that's not the case. On Android, you can... This is a separate discussion, but there might be some manufacturer has done a flaky implementation of the camera or something like that. So maybe a camera app isn't working, even though it might work perfectly on a Nexus. Now, that's a completely separate issue and something that shouldn't happen and terrible. But there's no such excuse for that behavior on Apple devices.
Well, I mean, that's true to a certain extent. Like when I get problems, I have never had a good experience with Gmail, and Google contains the entire stack for Gmail. And and I'm unique in that. A lot of people don't have the problems that I have with it. Or Hangouts. Hangouts has been hugely problematic for me over the last couple of years.
I could not defend Hangouts. I tried to use that when I was in the States recently, and I just... I wanted to throw the phone out the car.
It logs you out while you are using it. There should be a simple case. Is the person actively doing a hangout? If so, postpone log out, like automatic log out until they are finished using it.
Wow.
And they control the whole stack of that too. So, I mean, it's these companies are – so while Apple absolutely does control everything, they are no longer the tiny little Apple that had that four-quadrant product stack and had that one operating system. And scaling is the hardest thing in the world, especially scaling to Apple or Google and even Microsoft size. It's inevitable that there's a tremendous strain upon resources, a tremendous strain upon product lines, and you just lose the oversight. You can't have one CEO. You can't have even one VP. There's just too many products. So I absolutely agree with you. In a perfect world – I mean, there used to be this thing that only NASA could ship perfect code, and then they mixed up inches and centimeters and sent a probe to the wrong planet. And that should just never, ever happen. But we're humans, and we ship – I say we – I did like minor web development at most. But we ship bad code, and we try to fix it. And I think there are two distinct problems that Apple had recently that sort of put a magnifying glass on it. One was when they put in the new networking stack, and they got rid of MDNS what was it called? I'm blanking on the name now. They put in Discovery D.
Yeah.
And that was a plan that people inside Apple had said no to for years. And it eventually got to a point where continuity was shipping and they managed to convince people to do it. And it was just a nightmare. They could not get it to work. And Apple, you know, to their credit, after the fact, killed it. They put a bullet in it. They got rid of it. And I think they got rid of 350 different open radars at the same time by doing that. And they rolled back to MDNS Responder, backported all the changes they needed for continuity, and they moved forward. And as much as that never should have happened, I kind of am happy that Apple's gotten to a point where they're willing to do that instead of just stubbornly hitting their head against the spiky wall over and over again.
Certainly, swallowing their pride and rolling back, I think, was a good move there. But I think a far more pertinent question is how did that slip through? These were like, why was their testing not picking up these issues?
So one of the biggest, I think problem is a fair way to discover it, is that the nature of checking for software sort of changed, and it wasn't really appreciated at the highest levels. Apple was very proud of the fact that they believed internally that these were the most problem-free operating systems they ever shipped. And they were measuring it in terms of crashes. The amount of crashes on launch for applications in iOS and OS X were vastly down. They launched. And what they didn't fully appreciate, at least I think at the highest levels, were that annoyances are just as bad as crashes in volume. So if there were little problems...
Arguably worse, right? Because a crash, you know something's gone wrong. You can act on that. Whereas that's not the case if you've got your signal dropping out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So you have the system... the way it works is that they have an assigned severity for bugs. And there's a... I think there's P0, P1, P2. And as it gets closer to ship time, they start focusing on the more important bugs, the showstoppers. So things that would crash your system, for example, get a lot of attention. And even if the engineer, because these engineers are really, they're good people. They use the software. Their families use the software. They want it to be fantastic. They want to take huge pride in their craft, but they have a limited amount of time and there's a limited number of engineers. And for every company, what is their strength is also their weakness. So Apple's culture is an amazing strength for them, also a weakness. They have tiny teams, often single or double engineers working on a specific project, and they get to a point where they have to ship software. There's sometimes one engineer working on something. Like you can say, that guy did this.
I mean, I was aware of that to the point of, say, like the remote app that shipped on iOS 2 or whatever it was. I could understand that being, you know, something someone dillied with in their, you know, equivalent of 20% time or something. But man, I wouldn't have expected that to still be the case too much today.
So it's not a one-to-one relationship. Like someone might be working on a specific aspect of the software, but there are other people working on frameworks that help it from underneath, and HI designers who are working on the way that it looks, and program managers. So there is a team of people working on it, but there is always someone who's directly responsible for it. That's one of Apple's systems, is a DRI, directly responsible individual for all major features, because at the end of the day, that's the person who's responsible for it.
Is there a directly responsible tester or test department or something
that? Yeah, they have test department, but again, it's what are you measuring? What are your metrics? And as you get closer to shipping, what do you do? You make all of these things are compromises, because the perfect software would never ship. It would just never ship if you had to get rid of every bug. We have this wonderful dichotomy where every year I get all these emails saying, Apple should just slow down. I don't want them to do any new features. I just want them to fix everything except for these two things that I desperately need. And everyone's two things that they desperately need are different. Sure. And then Apple, when Apple does do things that are at least overtly less ambitious, people are like, oh, they're falling behind. They're not innovating anymore. And so we are not happy.
I mean, I think it's very easy for, you know, headline mongering analysts to shout that sort of stuff, anti-Apple analysts, but I don't think too many consumers are looking at Apple each year and thinking, gosh, they didn't do quite enough this year. I mean, there was that one iOS release where I remember where they added VIP accounts to mail and that sort of stuff. I think it was
iOS 4. 9 got a lot of pushback for not having enough features.
Yeah, I mean, they spent a bunch of time, obviously, on the new iPhone with 3D Touch and that sort of stuff. So I think as a whole, I don't think there was, I certainly didn't have too many complaints there. And I guess one of the things that Russell and I touched on there is that maybe they're framing their OS releases wrong. Like the idea that they have to release an OS update to add transit directions to their map application is just bonkers, right?
Yeah, I try not to jump around too much, but just to finish off that previous thought is that, what they're doing now is paying more attention to the things that we would call, I don't know, as opposed to crashers, frustrators. I don't know what the best word is for that. Mm-hmm. And maybe giving people time to spend on that because the engineers, they just want more time to do it. And it sounds dumb to say a company with hundreds of billions of dollars is resource constrained, but Apple is absolutely resource constrained. There's fierce competition for engineers. Google wants them. Facebook wants them. IPOs are very lucrative. A lot of engineers want to go there because they can be in an initial investment and get a lot of money out of them. That's not available from existing companies. And a lot of people don't want to work in Cupertino. And while Apple is relaxing that, there are still many jobs that require you to be in Cupertino. And some people just absolutely do not want to be in Cupertino.
That's a fair point. And do you feel like that, do you get any sense as someone who watches the company very closely that they're making more strides to stop these bugs or try and catch these bugs before they ship out?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's just a question of devoting the resources to them. And there's a famous line, I think it was from Pixar. I just remember John Siracusa quoting it, that success hides problems. And when everything is going gangbusters and you look at your crash logs and you say, oh, look, you know, we have the least crashes ever, you may not stop and look and go, oh, but you know, this person's complaining about the resprings and that person's complaining about accessibility feature and this, you know, those things are all there. It's just and we all do this. I mean, calling Apple is kind of disingenuous because it's not a monolith. It's not like a monoculture. It's a bunch of different people and they all have jobs to do and they all have to get stuff done, and they make decisions every day about I have the time to fix this, but this is way more important. I have to get this fixed. So if you're not experiencing big bug, you're experiencing little bug. It seems to you like you're not getting any attention, but really the guy is busy fixing big bug, or guy or one more, you know, the person is busy fixing big bug and not fixing the little bug that bothers you.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a case that could be made there, and the other is that. It is, you have to acknowledge that a lot of these issues can be very difficult to show up in metrics, as you sort of mentioned before. A crash is a crash, you can catch that. But I don't know, it's not so easy to necessarily log that people manually went in and toggled Wi-Fi on and off so they could restart their connection and that sort of stuff.
Well, it's also, I mean, the complexity of software has gotten to a point where, like, it used to be, I mentioned Core Audio. Core Audio was just bad for everybody. Like there were certain things that we just all knew were terrible across the line. And those are things that everybody wanted fixed. But now, I would say 99% of things that you and Russell spoke about, I've never encountered, but I encountered a lot of things that you and Russell never mentioned. And the level of complexity is such that you have the butterfly effect, a bunch of initial conditions come together to make a problem surface itself at some point in your experience. And it's different. There may be 100,000 people here, 50,000 people there, and that's a lot, but it's not out of 100 million people. And figuring out the priority to fix those in, if you can reproduce the situation that caused them, it's non-trivial at that point. And it's absolutely a problem. It's absolutely frustrating. It absolutely needs to be fixed. But it's not a thing like, they're just being jerks. It's a hard problem to solve.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, you did a good job of keeping me on track there. So it's very obvious who's the more experienced podcaster here.
No, not at all. I had a half-formed thought that I didn't want to.
So let's move on to the App Store itself, which was something Russell and I spoke about. What were your sort of thoughts listening to what we chatted about there?
Yeah. So, I mean, in general, a lot of these things are non-trivial. Like, I'm going to use that word a lot, but the App Store is one of these things. It's like everybody wants it fixed, but you say, what do you want? And some people say, oh, I want upgrades and I want trials, but that's saying I want a faster horse. That's not saying I want a car. One of my big things is I always try to think in terms of problems that I need solved and not solutions that I think I want, because when you state problems in terms of solutions, it's self-limiting. It's like if they don't give me A, then you know it's all wrong, but maybe they'll come across B, which is way better for your problem. So I always try to figure out what's wrong.
I think that's a good point there, in that, and it circles to the fact that Apple traditionally don't do focus testing, right? Because if you just get a bunch of people together, then they're going to say, look around and see the shiniest thing they can think of and say, I want that. And no one's ever going to, you know, invent an iPhone with a touchscreen in that regard. So I think there's absolutely merit to that. But I think the frustration many people feel with the iOS App Store is it just feels like they're doing nothing.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of problems to unpack there. One of them is like you and Russell mentioned what Google's done, which is take a bunch of apps and move them into the App Store, because then theoretically they can be updated outside of iOS releases. But iOS isn't Android, and the way that iOS works is a lot of those apps are really just thin front ends for core foundational features of the phone. Like you have to reboot for Apple Music because Apple fundamentally changed the way that music is handled internally on the device. So now you have full Siri integration, for example, but that Siri integration requires you to reboot Siri, which is part of Springboard. So the whole phone has to get rebooted. Otherwise, Siri wouldn't know to play Taylor Swift when you asked them to play the Taylor Swift song. So all that stuff is incredibly intertwined. And I actually went back and looked. And when podcast.app, and I forget the other one, it was Find My Friends or something.app, were in the App Store, they got updated less often than they were updated when they were part of the core OS features. It's just they didn't get any attention and they didn't really need any attention. And
they're now they're pretty outlying apps, though, I would think. Like no one's hanging their hat on, Find My iPhone and Apple have obviously long since not done much with their podcasting app, right?
They gave it a music style upgrade for iOS 9 and it got Siri functionality previously. So, I mean, it's the same thing like Apple should unbundle iTunes, but then you look at the Mac App Store.app and you look at iBooks.app and they're neglectware at this point. So being unbundled from iTunes isn't a solution. So that's just, again, the point of, you know, people say they should do this or that, but in and of themselves, those things don't really mean anything. Like you could add an upgrade feature and it could still be a terrible store. So when I hear that, I think people want help with conversion because people see paid apps and there's so many free apps that they don't necessarily want to pay for an app up front. But, you know, adding things like trials, does that really help in a world where venture capitalists are giving billions of dollars away to companies that don't have any business plan? They just want to acquire large amounts of users. Does it really matter when Microsoft or Facebook or someone can give an app away for free because it's not core to their business? So I think there's absolutely huge problems with sustainability and with things like incremental revenue from upgrades. I'm just not sure that fixing those things and not fixing the underlying problems would really help. So my thinking is that Apple needs to fundamentally change the way the App Store works, because right now the frameworks are made by Craig Federighi's team. The developer relations, App Store review, and evangelism is under Phil Schiller. And store management, the store infrastructure, and editorial is under Eddie Q. And those are three completely, you know, different organizations, some of which are larger than most companies in the world.
Is there an App Store VP?
No, which is something that I would really like to see. So it's like you have someone in charge of developer relations, you have someone in charge of the physical App Store, you have someone in charge of the App Store app, but there's no one person in charge of that. And I think Tim Cook has done an amazing job. He put Angela Ahrens in charge of retail and online. He put Johnny Ive in charge of HI and ID. He put Craig Federighi in charge of iOS and OS 10. And I think that there's an argument that could be made that if you had one person who was a public facing, or at least one person who was responsible across organizations, and their only job was to make the App Store terrific every day, that's the kind of solution I think we need for these problems. And maybe that will involve upgrades, and maybe that will involve demos. Maybe it'll involve something we hadn't thought of before. Maybe there'll be a premium app boutique that just features high quality apps outside of the bazaar that the App Store has become. There could be all sorts of different solutions, but I think that until there's someone whose job it is to make that terrific, all the other stuff doesn't really matter. It doesn't really fix the underlying issues.
It's kind of bonkers that that hasn't that position hasn't doesn't exist, right? Or hasn't been filled.
Well, there's a director of App Store in the iTunes org, but again, that has nothing to do with all. So famously, for example, people get upset when apps are rejected, but these things aren't black and white. So extensibility comes out in iOS 8, for example, and they make widgets in the notification center. And because there's incredible constraint on the amount of memory that they're giving them and other system resources, they basically say no apps. All you can do is display information and provide a way to go back to your apps. You can't put an actual app in here because it'll be a terrible experience. But then someone like James Thompson comes along who worked on the Finder, and he's like, I can put an entire calculator in here. Hmm. And he does it. And in the flood of apps coming out for iOS 8, people are just approving things that don't crash, basically. App works, approve it. And it goes through, and anything that gets approved can be featured by editorial. The only criteria is that it's an approved app. So they see it. They go, this is terrific. It's a whole calculator, notification center. We're making it a featured app. And so the actual frameworks that the developers made work, and the store thinks it's great because all the store wants to do is make money. So it's a $10 app. Let's feature that. That's great. And then everything calms down, and the people in charge of app review go, wait a minute, this is contrary to what we said we wanted in the App Store, and we're going to take it out if you don't change it. And that sounds nuts to people, but they believe at a very deep level that having an app in there that could be crashy is going to be a bad experience for their users. So they want to go and take that out and have it restored back to just being like an informational display. And then a whole brouhaha kicks up. And in the end, they decide, wait a minute, well, this actually works. And someone high up enough looks at it and goes, this doesn't crash. It's a great experience. Maybe we were being too hesitant or too conservative. Let's allow it in. And then that opens the gates to a whole new category of apps. But it's more of like a family arguing over a dinner table, figuring out what the right choice is, than any sort of, almost like I don't know if Microsoftian is still a fair term, but any sort of government bureaucracy where a form is stamped and it's a yes or no from the start. It's more of a we'll find our way through. And is that terrible? I don't know. If it wasn't for that, maybe it would have taken a year to get calculators in the App Store. It would be a new feature or something. So it's terrible, and it should never happen outside of Apple, but it's sort of the result of the way that Apple's structured.
So on the App Store, as far as the reviews, as we sort of sit here in very late 2015, can you think of any reason to justify why there would still be this process where apps are taking 7, 8, 9 days to get a 10-minute run through by an Apple engineer tester before they get ticked off and then the rollout happens?
Yeah, I mean, like that's sort of a problem of legacy with the App Store. Like, if they could hit the reset button and just start accepting apps now, I think the process would be not too dissimilar from the Google App Store. But it's a fire hose that never stops spraying. And unless you physically stop it and, you know, let the people keep working and don't let people submit apps for a while, you don't catch up. I mean, the original intent was for them to look at the app. So I think there is value in it. I don't think we're seeing the value from it, if that makes sense. Like, in an ideal world, the human looking at it would do things like catch, not malware, like malware they can detect, even the stuff like Xcode Ghost, they're getting better at detecting that kind of stuff. And they'll get better at that every time they encounter it. Mm-hmm. But the stuff like someone makes like flappy wings and then blappy wings comes out. Like that's a much better human thing to discover. Or if an app says that it does A and you open it and it does B, that's a static analyzer wouldn't know that. It would just check the code and say, oh, the code works, and it would go through. But a human would go, wait a minute, this isn't a trombone at all. This is a saxophone. This is complete BS. You can't do this.
And to that, I'd say, though, like, I don't really, I mean, Google have technically got human editors checking apps on the store, but as I mentioned previously, it's not something I've ever noticed. But Google have had from the very get-go that anyone can just release an update when the developer decides it's ready and it rolls out. And Google, there's a lot more flexible APIs on Android, and that means there's a lot more potential for damage. And the world hasn't been set afire. Like, I can't think of any controversy that spawned out of Google's decision to allow developers to control when their apps roll out.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a different approach to the two. And I was just, my point before I forget it, was that if you did see the clone apps disappear, like I think Apple has the potential to stop a lot of the fakery, and I forget what the term is for them. There's a term for apps that just want to rip off other apps, but we don't see that. Those apps still get through. So I think the problem is that we don't see the benefit of that a human review system. So it makes it harder to justify. But absolutely, the counter argument to that, though, is that the best thing that could happen is for fantastic quality Android apps to totally eclipse the App Store. But it hasn't happened. For as much as people say Google is more open, Google has more advanced APIs, Google has a better review system, it hasn't manifested itself. If Google had amazing apps, tremendous apps, apps that just blew away the App Store in terms of quality, it would be such an easy win. Like, people would say, oh my God, Apple's crazy, we've got to fix this. But it, for whatever reason, it just hasn't happened. My dream would be the world where there was like terrific, and Pocket Cast is a great app, but it's an app that can exist on iOS. Apple has yet to be presented a case where the Android system has worked better enough that they want to change the iOS system. And I think that's the sort of thing that it would take. And I really hope that happens. But for some reason, those apps don't exist on Android either yet.
It wouldn't take them just listening to their developers who don't want to work in this, who by and large.
What's the pain point there? So developers on the hierarchy, like Apple cares about Apple first, then customers, then developers. And that might be a horrible way to look at it, but from Apple, you know, they want the company to be sustainable, and then they want their customers to be happy. And then after that, they worry about developer concerns. And for them, Candy Crush is making a fortune. There's Office and Adobe Photoshop on the App Store. And I'm not saying, I love indie developers. I will buy an indie developer app, you know, sight unseen. Doesn't matter what the cost is, I'll support them. I'll patronize them for 4 years if I can in one shot. But I'm the exception to that. Most people, they don't care. They want to get a free app, and if there's an in-app purchase, they'll get rid of that app and get another one that's free. That's the market of the App Store. And Apple could do a lot to change that, but just to help developers is a very ambiguous thing to me.
Oh gosh, I'm having a moment where I'm spacing out here. Yes,
and again, sorry. I don't mean that to be offensive to developers.
No, I was going to say you said what's the upshoot to their customers? I would say there's absolutely negatives to their customers who are using apps that have obviously got bugs in them, and developers can't get a fix out. Like Russell mentioned, they had one in Pocket Casts where they had a crash in their settings, and they had developers for 7, 8, 9, 10 days getting in touch going, this is broken. And they're like, yep, we fixed it, we got the review in, and it's not right, it's sitting in Apple's mythical queue somewhere.
Absolutely. So that, as a discrete element, the inability for review to push out bug fixes, I mean, again, the perfect world, just like Apple would never ship bugs, developers would never ship bugs, right? So, but we don't live in those perfect world. We live in a world where everybody is shipping bugs, and there has to be something in the system that allows for those kinds of things. And it's supposed to be expedited reviews, but expedited reviews are not something that developers can rely on either. So there are things that absolutely have to be fixed and have to be fixed for the better, but there has to be when you're working at Apple's scale, like Facebook and Twitter, for example, they get bug updates put through immediately. I think there's like 900 versions of Facebook some days, it seems like, come out on Twitter. But if you have 100,000 developers all of a sudden submitting, like the Apple system doesn't seem to scale for the amount of success that they've had with it. And that might require, the same way I think it requires a rethinking of how the App Store is organized internally at Apple, I think it requires a rethinking of how the entire system works. Because again, it is based on an ancient framework devised for selling music 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And that has to be rebuilt. But it's also a multi-billion dollar economy. There's, I forget what the number is, $4, 5, 6 billion a year going through the App Store. And that is hard to touch. Because if that breaks, it's calamitous. So it's the same way, like, you can't just tear down a bridge and then put up a new bridge. You have to very carefully build a better bridge alongside it. And then when that bridge is perfect, you subtly redirect everybody onto it. And sort of my hope is that we'll get like what happened with the Apple.com, where store.apple.com was a hot mess of web objects. And then one day you go to Apple.com and web objects are all gone. And suddenly there's this one seamless brand new Apple.com that does the store and the products together. And they built that almost in total secrecy, no one paying attention, then just redirected everybody there. And I'm hoping beyond hope, because as bad as it is for us, it is worse for people inside Apple. Like it is not a manageable system there either. And I'm hoping that they are actually building that sort of a thing, and we will very quickly be rerouted into it.
What do you mean it's how is it worse for internal Apple employees there?
Because they care about internal Apple employees even less than they care about developers. So like if you use iTunes Connect, that is light years beyond what a lot of people inside Apple have to work with.
Wow, okay. So on the App Store, let's switch to the Mac App Store. I think we've mainly been speaking about the iOS App Store there. I guess a lot of it covers both, but the Mac App Store in particular, you wouldn't really say that's taken off the way Apple might have intended, right?
Yeah, so again, like to me, this goes back to the same core problem is like whose job is it to make the Mac App Store awesome? Like right now, the Mac App Store lives in the shadow of the iOS App Store. And if you're Apple and you're making billions of dollars on the iOS App Store, every resource goes towards that. And there's no one really advocating or fighting for the Mac App Store. And as much as we say it needs parity, it needs test flight support, it needs all the features that have been rolling out for the Mac App Store, analytics. And I mean, again, it goes back to that you want to unbundle iTunes. Mac App Store is unbundled from iTunes. It is just as neglected as is arguably more neglected than iTunes.app is. And I think it takes a fundamental rethinking of how Apple runs that internally. And you've got to have someone who wakes up in the morning and whose job it is to make the Mac App Store awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely, no one would describe it as awesome at the moment. And just today, Sketch announced that they're abandoning the App Store, the Mac App Store.
Sketch. I mean, Sketch is hard because they're grumpy. They didn't want to make an iPad app, an iPad Pro app, and that's fine because they don't think that they can monetize it. But it's a different market. It's I don't know a good way to describe it, but there are people who make a ton of money on the Mac App Store and a ton of money on the iOS App Store because their business models are directly aligned with them. And there's a lot of the problem with the Mac App Store is that you have traditional Mac developers who are used to things like shareware and upgrades and trials and things like that, trying to exist in an environment that is not just not ideal for it, but actively hostile to those things. And there will be apps that are born of the Mac App Store age and are perfectly fine in it, but there are also apps that just sandboxing is a non-starter for them, or some other prohibition is a non-starter for them, and it just does not suit them. The lucky thing about the Mac is it's not a one-store place. You can sell from the web. You can sell directly to customers, so you can maintain those traditional models, but either it'll take new apps with new business models that take advantage of what the Mac App Store can do, or it'll take a fundamental rethinking of what the Mac App Store is.
Yeah. Okay. Let's change tacks a bit. In the last few months we've had the iPad Pro, the Apple TV, and the iPhone 6S, which is still newish. Yes. How many times do you estimate you have entered your Apple password on an Apple device in the last few months?
Yeah. So this is one of those things again where, so there's one of the things, like when I write an article for iMore, one of the things I always make, there's two things I always make sure I do. One is to try to think of solutions and not just state problems. The other is to try to think of the repercussions for the solutions that I state. Because it's one of my favorite stories is I had a friend who went to work at Apple years ago, and he arrived and he said, you know, I have answers to all these problems because I have read the internet. He didn't really say it in those terms, but that was sort of the thinking that he had. It's like, you guys are idiots. Yeah. Everyone knows how to fix these problems. And then they just put this box in front of him that said, this is when we tried that 4 years ago. This is when we tried this 3 years ago. This is when we tried this 2 years ago. And here's the file on why that didn't work. And a lot of things are really easy for me to say on a podcast, like Apple should do this, Apple should do that. Like the password thing, absolutely, you have to enter it way too often. But why do I have to enter it, and what's the alternative? If I don't enter it, for example, when you reboot, certain things require you to re-enter your password because it has to re-authenticate you with the iCloud server. And if you didn't do that, there'd be no secure state for that phone. And is that preferential to me? I mean, some people don't really care about security, so maybe
for
them
that's fine. But that's down to Apple's implementation, right? Like it always strikes me as entirely odd when I was using the iPhone and I would restart it for whatever reason. And then I would have one of these apps nagging me to leave a review. And I'm like, okay, actually, I like this app. I'll leave you a review. And then I go to the App Store and I can't leave a review without entering my Apple password. And the fact that Apple thinks my device is secure enough with a fingerprint that, you know, you can have access to my entire phone, my entire world, but that is not enough security for me to leave a review on the App Store. Like that's just crazy to me.
Yeah. So again, and I look at this from both sides because I see the results of whenever Apple is not secure, it's front page headlines. It's like the worst thing in the world. Like I remember you and Russell were saying, you know, why does Apple get away with this stuff? I have the exact opposite reaction. Like I see a world where Apple puts out a fingerprint sensor and it's front page news how someone can take a CSI style fingerprint and try to spoof it. But HTC and Samsung can launch with a fingerprint sensor that leaves actual live fingerprint data in a universally readable file. But it's not a headline. Like one or two sites write about it. It's not front page news. So like I think that both things are true. Like Apple, there are a lot of people who try to explain away what Apple does, but anything that they do, even when it's not true, is a front page headline.
Yeah.
And they have to balance security. So anytime that they don't, that you're in an unknown state, it asks you for your password. And also after certain parameters, like if you haven't used something in 48 hours, it doesn't ask you for your fingerprint. Fingerprints legally and physically are different things. Like if you fall asleep, no one can get at your phone, but if you fall asleep, someone can put your finger on that phone. If you're arrested, no one can compel you for a password, but they can compel you to put your finger on a sensor. So there's, in an ideal world, like for me, things like the Apple TV are more indefensible. So the Apple TV, it's been 2.5 years since they released it, but they spent 2 years working on very different Apple TVs and then kind of, I think it's fair to say rushed this out. Like this is a hot device arriving.
You do think they rushed it out or didn't?
No, absolutely. It absolutely was rushed out. Like this is not the Apple TV that they've been working on for this many years. They were working on a set top box. They were working on all sorts of different things. And then finally, like we got to get something out and this was it. And it shipped with like no serious support for music. Just a whole bunch of things that should be there aren't there. And yeah, they're going to add them, but I mean, they're not there right now. And the one thing for me is like you tap to set up that Apple TV and it asks you for your password on your iPhone. But then 2 minutes later, it's asking you for your password on your Apple TV. And you just showed me that you can transit passwords onto my iPhone. So just keep doing that.
Yeah.
I don't even need a remote app. Like screw the remote app. I don't care if there's a remote app or not. Just make the password show up on my iPhone.
Well,
you can do that.
I did need the remote app because the example I gave where I don't know my Apple password, it's in my password app. And so it popped up with this dialogue over Springboard saying enter your password. I didn't have it cached and I couldn't get that dialogue back. If it was like maybe went to a notification or something, but that was the crux of the problem. I didn't know my password at that instant, so I had to dismiss that dialogue and I couldn't get it back. But yes, I mean, the whole Apple onboarding process, like When I log into a new Android device, I enter my Google password and I do the two-factor text message, and then I'm done.
Do you know your Google password, or do you have to get that off of Password Manager?
I do know that one. That is the one.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. I know my Apple password. Like, I know my Apple password, and I know my Dropbox password because I can't do anything without those. I can't like enable one password. I can't do anything without those things.
Yeah. No. I know the Google one, but. But yes, but once you log in, then they immediately use that same authenticated account for Hangouts and Gmail and all the rest of it, and basically across their entire suite of apps. Apple don't do that. And not only don't they do that, they don't provide an option to do it. So you have to log into, when you get a new device, then you have to then log into what, iCloud is a separate login?
No, so they should all be, like in a perfect setup, they are all universal. Once you log in for iCloud, it will log you into everything else. The problem is that oftentimes, and Apple is not a cloud services company. Like they try really, really hard. They're terrible at it. Getting better, arguably, but they're terrible at it. And quite often, they don't get the right response. Like the response does not come back. So then it doesn't log you into the other services. So when you go to them, it asks you to log in because, again, unknown state. So that's an example of, I don't know if I could call that a bug. That's just them traditionally not being good at cloud services.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's what, it feels like. It feels like Apple, the way that I have to constantly enter my passwords on their devices, it feels like Apple just acknowledging that we're not very good at this stuff, so the safest way we can think to guarantee your safety is to just ask you for your password all the time. And that just, it feels like such a cop-out.
Yeah, I don't get asked for my password often. Like my iTunes password, I'm one of those people who had an iTunes account for so long that it's not my iCloud password. It was tied to another email address, and I can complain about the fact that you can't merge accounts still. Like it's 1990.
You can't do that with Google either.
No, it's yeah, and I understand it's also very, like all these things I complain about. I can't solve these problems either, but I can complain about them. So they're all really hard problems to solve. But so I have a separate iTunes account from my iCloud account. So there's some advantages to the way that the Apple TV is set up because it was super easy for me to put in different ones and it actually read both of them off my device and set them both up for me separately.
I think it's really great that they allow that, but that shouldn't be the default, right?
No, but I don't know. Like so a lot of the stuff is interesting. The Apple TV doesn't support Bluetooth keyboards, and it turns out that maybe 2% of people who had an Apple TV use Bluetooth keyboards, and almost all of them are developers. But when you look at Twitter or you look at a lot of blogs, it's the developers tweeting and blogging about it. So you think it's a huge deal, like this Apple totally abandoned keyboards. But no, you guys are using the term muggles, right? I typically say like civilians or something.
Muggles,
it's a total non-issue for them.
Yeah.
So
but, I would agree on the Bluetooth keyboard. What do you think about the remote app, the lack of Apple TV support there?
Yeah, so it's the same thing. It's like the limited resources, not enough time to get it done. And it's not just updating the remote app, but the remote app now has to support the same kind of gesture experience that you have. And theoretically, it has to transit Siri, which the old remote app didn't do. And transiting Siri is not something that, like, the watch doesn't even transit Siri. It's got its own built-in Siri. So then does the phone control Siri? Does the phone just send commands to the... I mean, like, it is a larger problem to solve, and whether they abandon it or they solve it, that's fine. But again, to me, the problem is not a remote app. I have a remote. It works fine. It's just I want to be able to enter passwords. So let me either use Touch ID or let me enter the password on my phone where I have a virtual keyboard that's much faster than the one on the Apple TV.
Yeah, I think Touch ID, the inability to use that, I just found inexplicable. Like, because I think Touch ID is so terrific.
Yeah, so again, it's like like when Apple first announced Touch ID, there was no Touch ID API, and people are upset by this. But the reason is that Touch ID just releases a yes/no token, and that if an app gets a yes/no token, you can't trust the developer. He might just say yes every. Oh yeah, we got a yes token. That's fine. Like, there was no way to authenticate the response. So Apple spent the next year tying it into Keychain. So now the app doesn't get the token; it goes straight to Keychain, and then Keychain reads it and releases the credentials to the app, which is a much better implementation. It took longer, but it's a smarter implementation. And
that's fine. But Apple should be able to control that with their own internal apps, which is why...
Absolutely. But again, like, how do you transit a fingerprint to a television set over radio? And is there a person in the middle attack there? Can it be spoofed once you know what it is? I mean, like, these things, again, it sounds simple to me, but I don't know the security implications of these things.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't say I'm an expert in that area either. I just feel like when I use Apple's devices, I have to enter my password an inexplicably high number of times compared to as I use an Android device. And because of that, it makes me feel less secure.
Well, you know, absolutely. Like, again, I know my Apple password, but it's still super long and as close to pseudo random as I can possibly remember.
Can you remember? Yeah.
So it's like a 20 digit long thing with a bunch of garbage put into it, but I still have to remember myself to type it in, and I feel that pain too. But those kinds of things, I hope they figure out smart ways to solve them, but I hope they don't figure out dumb ways to solve them.
So as far as product onboarding, I certainly ranted quite a bit about the Apple TV onboarding process in the previous episode. Do you feel this is something that Apple have slipped on? Is it something that they're just not putting enough emphasis on? Do you think it's an issue?
Yeah. So, and I don't mean this as a cop-out at all, but it's one of those things where... I would love Sprint, I think, was caught in the U.S. installing an enterprise certificate to bypass setup because they were saying it was too long for their customers. And that's a horrific solution because, you know, then Sprint is basically a person in the middle attacking everything on that phone.
What was that on an iPhone?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I completely missed that. That's dreadful.
Yeah. So, it's horrible. But the thing is, it's a really long process. And I think it's too long. But what would I take out of it? I mean, like, now they have, like, Hey Siri set up there and location services and privacy. And I could see taking out any one of those things. But then I think about it from, like, I'm a normal user and I'm setting this stuff up. And would I even know about this stuff if it wasn't there? And would I know to turn it on? Do I need to know to turn it on? Maybe I don't need Hey Siri. Maybe I don't need location. Maybe I don't need to set up Touch ID. But then would I ever set it? So it's one of those things where I don't know a really good solution for it yet.
Well, I think the most obvious thing that comes to mind is that you do more prompting, you know, via Springboard or something like that over time. You know, hey, you haven't set up Siri yet, you haven't set up Touch ID and that sort of stuff. So I think there are other ways there. But
well, those are dangerous too, because then, like, there's a thing where at least they're doing it upfront. So yeah, it's super frustrating and long, but when you actually start to use something and then, like, you want to do something, you actively press something. Hey, did you know we have Touch ID? You're like, I just want to do something. It's like apps that offer to update when you launch them. And yeah. You're like, but I need to use the apps. Well, update later. And then it's never, it's one of these things. And it's also like, we have this problem now, I think on Android and iOS, where they're doing more dynamic prompts for permission. Initially, it was all front loaded. Like, I would launch an app. I'd launch a Twitter app, for example. Can I have permission to use your Twitter accounts? Yes. Your photographs? Yes. Your location. Yeah. And you would just, yes, leave me, or no, just leave me alone. And it was really dialogue fatigue. And now it's more dynamic. So I'll go to make a tweet and then it'll say, can I use your location? And then I'll go to add a photo. But it's still a lot. And it's especially a lot for people who don't understand like what is using storage on your device mean, or it is informative, but it is also hostile. And I always thought maybe a sheet that could come up that have yes and no switches for all these things at once would be less interruptive, but would people actually read it and make it? These are the toughest problems to solve for me right now, is onboarding and permissions. And I don't think anyone has solved them well. And I certainly don't have a better idea yet, but I think removing them isn't ideal either.
Yeah, I think Google did a pretty solid implementation with Android Marshmallow, in that, because on iOS, the dialogue only comes up once, right? Like if you select cancel, then you have to manually go digging into the system settings.
It can come back if you try to do, like if you say no photos and then you try to do a photo thing, it can say, whoops, you turned off photo things, please go and turn them back on.
Okay, because on Android you get two tries. The first time it just comes up saying, you know, do you give access to the camera? And then if you set no, then the next time the app requests, there's a little dialogue saying never ask me again, which I think is a subtle way of handling it, and it seems a little more friendly to developers that way. But it's a bit, you know.
Well, there's that other. Under Scott Forstall at Apple, they said no to a lot more things. Like famously, he would not allow AirDrop. Like there's just so many things we have in iOS now that he said no to. And it made iOS a much simpler system. And under Scott Forstall, arguably, there was greater software stability, although there were still some horrendous bugs. But now with Craig Federighi, he skews more towards the geeky, and Apple skews more towards adding functionality. And that comes at a cost. And now we have added levels of complexity, and we have like things like extensibility, where you can surface. We talked about this on another show, but like what's an app going to be in 2 years? Because I don't open pCalc anymore. I slide down Notification Center. I don't go to the Pinterest app. I just use the Share extension. You know, those apps may as well not exist as apps, as discrete binaries anymore. All their functionality, the same way that HTTP services unbundled websites, extensibility and what Google's done with sharing has unbundled apps. And I don't know how a developer is going to handle that eventually when their work is now piecemeal, flying over to my watch, flying over to my car, showing up in my other app. You know, this whole thing is changing. But the level of complexity for managing, I was using an Apple TV app that pulled the heart rate off my iPhone and showed it to me on the screen. And that's living on my iPhone in some way. And my mind is like blown by what this technology can do. But it is so much less simple than launching Super Monkey Ball and just turning my phone around.
That much is certainly undeniable. Okay, so let's move on. One of the things Russell and I spoke about quite a bit was a trend that we're noticing in Apple's base product line. And certainly John Gruber has mentioned quite a bit how he was always of the mind that it was good, better, best for the three, certainly, storage tiers on the iPhone and the different products that Apple have. And I sort of made the case pretty strongly that I feel like good has largely been eroded, and good is no longer good. The most obvious example there is the new Retina iMac that's come out with a 5400 RPM hard drive. And I think a case can also be made with a 16 gigabyte base iPhone when the iPhone's capable of recording 4K video. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so I mean, back when Apple had a very simple product line, they had a very small customer base, and a very simple product line can service a very small customer base. The Apple as it exists today can no longer have that kind of base because they're servicing so many people with different needs. So 16 gigabyte iPhone is a great example. For you and me, we might cringe at that. We might think that like most of the blogosphere, this is horrible. How can Apple do this to people? But Apple's like, so one of the things that I like to preface my work on is that I assume that Apple's not an idiot just going into
sure.
it. If they're doing something, it's not out of dumbness. Like it might be out of profitability, or it might be out of another reason, but they don't ever do anything. Like it's not just dumb that they put this in there. There's a variety of reasons for it. So a 16 gigabyte
iPhone. And I'd also add on that, they're making decisions. They know their future product lineups. They have a bunch of internal analytics that most people don't have. So they have by far and away the most information on which to make what they hope are good decisions. So yes, I think it's absolutely fair to give people, you know, acknowledge that that's where these decisions are coming from.
Plus, they want people to Apple is less interested in you buying the current iPhone than they're interested in you buying two more or three more over the years. That's
greater
value to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's not in their best interest to make really crappy products. But there are sometimes economic and sometimes customer based things. Like, for example, a 16 gigabyte iPhone doesn't make any sense to me, but I just, as a straw poll, I went around and I asked the muggles, the civilians that I knew, to show me on the about box. And, you know, my best friend has 10 gigabytes on his 64 gigabyte iPhone that he uses. He has never gotten anywhere close to 16 gigabytes. And when he realized that, he's now going to upgrade to the next iPhone at 16 gigabytes because he thinks he's going to save $100. My mom, likewise, she uses 8 or 9 or something. And I talked to a bunch of younger people too, and they don't keep content. Maybe they can take 4K video, but they don't care to. They stream all their music. They watch Netflix. They don't download. I download a ton of movies because I fly a lot. They don't download any of them. To them, it is a messaging and streaming box, and 16 gigabytes is fine. And beyond them, there are wafts of enterprise and education customers who would buy smaller iPhones if they could, because all they want is a mobile web portal for their employees to access B2B apps and or websites. And the local storage is irrelevant to them. And Apple sells millions and millions of units every year to them. So it's sort of like why they still have an iPad Mini 2 on the market, and the original iPad Air on the market, is there are buyers for whom large capacity and latest features are far further down, and price sensitivity is higher up on the purchase list.
Yeah, so I don't doubt that there are a massive number of people that fall into that category. I think I would mention an article I'm sure you're very familiar with, David Smith's article, where he quoted stats on the 16 gigabyte iPhones from his users. And I think he had it, what, at 37% of 16 gigabytes devices have less than 1 gig of space free. And I think it's absolutely fair to make the comment there that those stats were gleaned from a podcasting app or an audiobooks app? So if you're doing that, then those
are content downloaders. Yes. No, but they're content downloading you. Well, and also iOS 8 was hugely problematic because it was a large download, and people who had smaller devices just simply did not have room to download it, which is why we saw Apple launch things like asset slicing, or the whole app thinning umbrella, on-demand resources, asset slicing, Bitcode not so much for that, but also why they made iOS 9 so small. Like, it's 1-point-something gigabytes instead of, I think, 5 gigabytes for iOS 8, because it makes for a better process. And we could be seeing streaming updates. Like, I don't even know when Chrome is updated anymore. It just updates continuously in the background.
Yeah.
And that's probably the future of a lot of software, just continually streaming updates, as much as that might scare traditionalists like me who want absolute control over everything. But you know, that was a huge pain point, is that even if you only use 10 gigabytes, 12 gigabytes, you just couldn't download the update, and people hit a brick wall. Now that's no longer as big a factor. So I think there are definitely people who buy 16 gigabyte iPhones who buy it for the wrong reasons, but there is a huge market for 16 gigabyte iPhones, which is why Apple does it. For the 21.5-inch iMac, it's got a 2.5-inch drive in, not a normal 3.5-inch drive. And so the baseline for that is the equivalent of what the 7200 RPM 3.5 is, which, you know, 2.5-inch discs aren't as performant at the same levels as those other discs. But so again, it's like the stock thing that you just put in there to hit an education market or whomever they want it for. My thing is, I wish that they would separate out the – I wish it'd be a separate SKU for those. Like, I wish those would be marked separately so that people knew that these are for specific markets and or specific customers and weren't just part of the general population, because I think that would eliminate people who buy them confused and then get a machine that doesn't serve their needs.
Yeah. I mean, I think if there was a – if they added a lower tier enterprise or education market, whatever they wanted to call it.
The EMAC. Just,
yeah, exactly. Perfect. But the fact that people are walking into an Apple store and walking out with a brand new iMac that doesn't have a solid state hard drive, I find that indefensible, really. Like, at odds with Apple's, you know, goal, which we mentioned before, of building fostering a long-term relationship with a customer who will hopefully buy another iMac going forward.
Yeah. So again, I just default back to they're not stupid. So like, they're not doing it out of a sense of malice or a sense of like, they just don't know any better. And if you look at the MacBook line, I believe is SSD all the way through now. Like, I don't even, you may on the old Relic iMac, MacBook that they still sell for some reason, maybe that has a hard drive. I don't recall. The one that still has the optical drive in it. But I think across the line now, they're all SSDs. And that would be something that they could, do with the desktop computers too, but they obviously see a market for ultra. There's a market for them in desktops and people who buy desktops to have the cheapest possible solution rather than components. And same thing, like they could ditch the 16 gigabyte iPhone, but then the same time that people were complaining about the 16 gigabyte iPhone, they made the 64 gigabyte and 128 gigabyte $100 cheaper. So it's not like there's like no 32 anymore. It's essentially the 64 became the 32. And there's reasons for the, like there's different kinds of flash memories actually used in those phones. There's dual layer and multi-layer flash chips. And the way that those sizes work are a little bit different. So it's really expensive. I'm getting down an incredible rabbit hole now. The iPad
it's interesting because, I mean, I definitely don't feel like it's a case of Apple being stupid here. My opinion is it feels like they're being penny pinchers. And Tim Cook, who is, you know, obviously has his big ops background, I think he's made the conscious decision that they want to encourage people rather than buying the lowest product, which is still obviously a terrific product traditionally. They want people to buy the rung up so they can have the higher margins.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tip. So I have a marketing background, and that's sort of one of the first things you're taught in marketing is that you always have an entry-level product, a mid-level product, and a high-level product. And the low-level products will get people in the door, but almost everyone ends up buying the mid-range product. And then if people who really want to spend money buy the premium product. And that's just how it works, like the terrible toaster oven, the good toaster oven, and the extravagant toaster oven. And it's for refrigerators, for cars. It's like almost no one buys the entry-level car because it's terrible. It feels like you're driving around on wooden seats and you want to get the suspension package and the sports package and all. And that's typically how things are sold. And it's the reason why iPhones are sold with, like, it makes no sense to sell iPhones. Like, there's no correlation between memory size and $100 increments on the iPhone.
No.
Like, it doesn't cost $100 more for 64 gigabytes. It doesn't cost $100 more than that. You know, Apple used to make a black MacBook that cost $100 more. It's just they need something to make tiers, and people recognize that size is bigger, and bigger equates to more money. And psychologically, it's an easy transaction to make. It's the same way, oh, it's an exclusive color. I'm going to pay a little bit more for it. So like they could pick anything. Like screen size too, processor speed, there's all sorts of things. It doesn't really cost more for faster processor, at least not the same amount of money you're paying for it. But it's an easy, oh, it's faster, therefore more money.
Yeah.
So a lot of these things are consumer psychology. No, but I agree with you. I think that the low-end stuff, I think for the iPhones, it's fine. For the Macs, any sort of physical disc feels like an anachronism at this point. And I think it'd be better if they were labeled as such.
And you're obviously got a pretty keen watch on this. How much do you estimate it would cost Apple to each 16-gigabyte iPhone if they bumped it to 32 gig?
So, I mean, cost is a complicated thing. So first, the kind of memory they use, at least, I don't know if that's true this year. Last year, the kind of memory that they used, the NAND flash, it was relatively inexpensive at 16 gigabytes, but was super expensive at 32 gigabytes because it just, that's the way that kind of RAM technology works. It's basically dual layer, I think it's dual layer versus multi-layer, but I could be confusing the two. And the TLC RAM that they used in the higher iPhones, the 64 and 128, just didn't come in 32 gigabytes. And there's a case could be made that Apple could go and make it, but then it's super expensive because you're basically making your own bespoke RAM for an iPhone. So the 16 gigabytes, relatively economical. 64 and 128 gigabytes, relatively economical. 32, weird point. iPod Touch can do it because they don't have to have a radio in it, so they can actually use two slots, and then you just put twice 16 in, and you don't have to worry about a 32 double density chip in there. Mm-hmm. So it's easy, but also then you take the pressure off. Like their value is an average sale price, what they make their money for, what every analyst is looking for. Anytime they don't make margins, they are hammered in the stock market, and the best upsell they could possibly do was to not have a 32 gigabyte and make the 64 gigabyte $100 cheaper. Because then, there's a 16 gigabyte for people who really don't care about anything, who don't want any local storage personally or professionally. But then you're getting 64 gigabytes. It's like, I'm getting so much more for $100. So psychologically, it's an even more powerful upsell for them.
Yeah.
So it was literally the best of both worlds.
So you don't have any sense of exactly, it would cost $2, it would cost $32?
No, it's like that famous West Wing quote where, you know, that pill costs 4 cents. No, the second pill costs 4 cents. The first pill costs $1 billion.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. And I mean, so, I guess all of these are going to be, you know, paper, back in the napkin estimates anyway.
Well, so like, even if it costs $2 to make it 32 gigabytes, how many people do you then lose on the 64 gigabyte model? Like if because they, like the idea, it's not that people want a 30, like if Apple had 16, 32, 64, I don't think people would be happier. Or yeah, if they had 16, 32, 128, like I don't think that would make people happier. It's like they want Apple to get rid of the 16.
Yes, I definitely feel like Apple, like if the baseline were 32, then Apple, less people would buy the 64 and Apple's average selling price would be down and it would obviously cost a bit more for the extra space there. But my point on that is simply, it just feels like considering Apple go to such great lengths to foster a terrific relationship and want you buying products over and over again, it would be a better thing to do in the interest of that long-term relationship. But as I said, I don't think it's going to cause people to leave.
Look at it this way. Like Apple will, like the iPhone 6S, everyone says it's like an S update, right? Which is the incremental update. And it's, they basically rebuilt that thing by the atom. It would have saved them so much money if they had just replicated what they did before. The iPhone 5, they rebuilt it again by the atom. They spend exorbitant amounts of money on these things. So I don't know. It's like, I don't know how expensive it is to chamfer an edge. I don't know how expensive it is to create 7,000 series aluminum for this stuff. I don't know how expensive it is to make a tap. Like they spend ungodly amounts of money on these things. And arguably some of this money they don't need to spend. So I'm not sure how, whether it's a question of how much it costs as opposed to it's a question of, we know this percentage of our customer base only uses 10 gigabytes and they'll be fine with this. And we know that everyone else will now get 64 gigabytes for what we used to charge for 32 gigabytes. And it's an even more tempting upsell for people who are kind of on the border of it. So like the way they look at it, I think for them, they are making great products. It's not like they're deliberately saying, screw you people, you're getting 16 gigabytes, stub out my cigarette on the floor and walk out of the room.
This is only 2G and or anything like that.
Yeah, no, I think they are doing what they think serves, and they have great data. Like they know how much memory people use on their phones better than anybody else. And if it was a huge problem, I think that they would correct it. Like the iPad Pro is interesting. They only have 32 and 128. There is no other SKU. Apple TV only has 32 and 64. There is no 128. And that's fascinating to me because Apple's almost always three SKUs. So I don't know what the data is telling them there. And is a 32 gigabyte on an iPad Pro, is that meant like for studios? Is that meant for medical institutions? I that is brand new, so I have less of a sense of it. But I think with the iPhone, they've been making it for so long, they really know what SKUs are going to sell the best for them and for their market.
Yeah. So you mentioned the different product configurations there. Do you, and you also mentioned at the top of the show, how did you describe it? Sorry, was it just the product quadrant?
Well, that was a famous Steve Jobs thing when he came back to Apple and he goes, oh, all these products are a mess. We're going to have consumer and professional, laptop and desktop, and that's it.
Yep. And so I think if you look at Apple's product lineup now, you definitely couldn't say that's still accurate, right? Like in the previous episode, Russell mentioned if you went online and tried to buy an Apple laptop, you wouldn't even know where to start at the moment, right?
Yeah, I mean, so this is the interesting thing to me because part of me really wants Apple to go back to being simple because even as a journalist, it'd be so much easier to explain. Like we write buyer's guides for all this stuff. It'd be so much easier to say, you buy this one, you buy that one, everybody happy. But at the same time, I also like the Apple that experiments, like the Steve Jobs who pulled that iPad Air first generation out of the envelope. And that was a wacky computer. I mean, that was terribly expensive. It had a horrible little mechanical hard drive on the normal one and an exorbitant SSD on the other one. It had a fold-down thing for ports. I mean, it was a wacky computer, but it was born of a vision that said, what could we do if we tried to make a MacBook more like an iPad? The iPad didn't exist for consumers at that point, but it existed internally at Apple. They've been working on mobile technology for years.
And now we have clearly a precursor for the way laptops have gone.
It was, and now we have the new MacBook, which in the same way, like people look at it, and it's absurd. It's only got one port. Look at all these adapters I need. And you want to take them by the hand and take them to the Apple store and go, look, there's a MacBook Pro right here for you. This is the one you should buy. But at the same, like Apple's thing is, what does a MacBook in a wireless world look like? What if we had no ports? And because you couldn't charge inductively through metal till this year, it had to have at least one charging port. So The one has a charging port. They're like, man, might as well do data. We'll use USB-C. So now it's got like a universal data and charging port. But the ideas in that computer, I think the same way, we'll see that resonate for the next few years. And it's an edge case and it's expensive. And I think it's unabashedly so, because it's not meant for everybody. It's meant for people who kind of want to play with that stuff now. And I'm mixed about Apple being more complicated that way, but I'm also kind of excited that they're willing to do those sorts of crazy. It's like the Samsung thing for me. I'm not a fan of Samsung products. I don't like anything that they make. I much prefer the LG stuff, the HTC stuff, even some of the Huawei and things now. But I like that they're the crazy uncle who tries all this wacky UI stuff, because every once in a while they'll come across something just pure genius. They'll propagate across the line.
They throw a lot up against the wall, and sometimes stuff sticks.
Yeah, some people say they created the trend for big phones. That's true, but when you make a phone at every quarter inch, you're going to stumble across big phones. You're going to stumble across everything. Yeah. And part of me loves that they do that, because that's not what other companies can either afford or are committed to doing. So with the stuff like the more complicated product lines, do we ultimately need an iPad mini and an iPad Pro? Do we need all the size? I think they'll sort of shuffle their way down, the way we don't have a 17-inch MacBook anymore. And we don't have a modern four-inch iPhone anymore, but other things will replace them, and they'll experiment with more things. And I kind of like that too.
Do you think Apple are going to suffer? I mean, well, I guess suffer is such a loaded
hundreds
term.
Of billions of dollars of suffering.
Yes. No, I just mean purely from the point of view of, it just used to be so simple when you go in the Apple store. And again, I mentioned this at the top of the previous episode, and I'll mention it again. Like, I'm definitely by no means with any of this thinking Apple are going to, you know, lose their market position or anything like that. They're so incredibly dominant and still create such tremendous products. There should be no argument there. But just from the point of view of, it just used to be a lot simpler. Now, yeah, if you want to try and buy a laptop, man, it is just confusing as to which way to go.
Well, I mean, it's still like, compared to other companies, it's a relatively restrained product line. But I tweeted this earlier today, the equal and opposite problem with focus is tunnel vision. Like, you're focused on something, you don't see the things that are around you. And the other problem with making these huge towers is that those towers cast incredibly large shadows. So there are things that get missed. There are things that don't get the attention that they deserve. And at the same time, as your market grows, you have customers whose needs are simply different. Like, you have $900 MacBook Air now. It's the 11-inch MacBook Air, but it's the $900 MacBook Air, and that didn't exist previously. I don't think the MacBook at $1,500 is a good entry-level machine, so the MacBook Air is still around. And yeah, it's a little more complicated to sift through, but it serves a greater market, and I think the alternative is worse for Apple. And there's a couple analogies I could give. One is, the iPhone used to be locked on AT&T in the US, and Apple sold tons and tons of iPhones, but it got to a point where anybody who was willing or able to be on AT&T and wanted an iPhone had it. And in order to get more customers, they had to go to Verizon. And it got to a point where Apple, like some people said, Apple was late to the big phone market. The big phone market in the US really didn't start until the iPhone went there, but it got to a point where some people wanted a big phone more than they wanted iOS, and they went and got a Samsung phone or another phone. And anybody who wanted a smaller than, like, anybody who was willing to put up with a small phone to have iOS, they maxed that out. So they had to go to their next addressable market. And that was iOS on a big screen phone. And now you can have both. You can have an iPhone off AT&T. You can have an iPhone bigger than 4 inches. And the only way to grow is to keep adding those addressable markets. So you can have a bigger MacBook. You can have a smaller iPad. That's how you grow your business. And I think the alternative is just being completely stagnant. And I don't think that's in their best interest either.
Yeah, sure. So the last sort of point that I wanted to touch on, which is, it feels like there's a few instances of a bit of a lack of care, for lack of a better description, in some of the products that go to market. I think the biggest one for me is the new Magic Mouse, and the fact that that charges upside down. Like, sell me on that.
No, so here's the thing. So lack of care is hard, because there are people who care deeply about these products. Like, I've met some of the product managers on them, and every one of them deeply, deeply cares about these products. the charging on the Magic Mouse, like on the bottom, that's the least of this thing's problems. Like I have one right here. I have never been a fan of any of Apple's mice. I just, the original Mac was nice because it had a mouse and I'd never seen one before. So that was fine. But the Hockey Puck mouse and the Mighty Mouse and none of those, I think all of those are terrible. But charging on the bottoms to me is like, it's like the silliest thing to hate about this mouse. I think the ergonomics and the way that those gestures and all. So I have this guy next to it, which I way prefer.
I actually have used the Apple Mouse for years, and I don't have a problem with it.
Like, do you? I
am one of those people that it's fine for me.
Yeah. So like I have one here, and when I need to charge it, like it charges quickly, and I just plug it in. And the alternative, I did a rendering of what it would look. So basically, I'm doing video right now, so it's easy for me to do this. But for audio, I'll explain it. You have a Lightning port on the back of the trackpad and the back of the keyboard, so you can use them while charging. But what a Lightning port needs is a flat surface. For which it is mounted on. And the current design of the Magic Mouse does not have that flat surface. And if you redesign it with that flat surface, or you cut a big wedge out of it to insert a flat surface, it's a completely different thing. And I'm holding up my hand now. So when you use a trackpad, your hand is arcing up. When you use a mouse, your hand is arcing down. And when your hand is arcing down, it is going to arc over that area. So you don't want a wedge there because that's all your fingers would feel. And you don't want a big flat surface there because you would have your fingers, instead of on the buttons, on a big flat surface. So given the constraints of Lightning at this time, unless Apple did a substantial redesign of the Magic Mouse and figured out a way around it, that is just the best place to put the port.
Such a big thing. You can't use and charge this mouse at the same time.
How often do you charge? You charge it once every 3 months and you just put it on overnight, like, and you come back to it.
Like on the Apple Pencil, it kind of looks a bit odd how you flip that and charge it in the iPad and it's sticking out. But they made the point of saying it only needs, 15 seconds charge and then you're fine for however long it is.
Not long enough.
Well, I can't speak to it. I haven't got one. But Russell,
that to me is actually a problem because the Apple Pencil is the only outie. Everything else is an innie. So it's just super easy for me to plug it into cables. But then I plug in my iPad to charge and that port's being used now, so I can't plug in the Pencil. And they give you an adapter, but like I understand why it's an outie, because an innie is structurally bigger. So it's more economical for them to do an outie, but it's different enough that my brain doesn't click on it. Where the Apple Mouse, I just flip it over and stick the plug in, and then I go get some coffee and I come back and I set a reminder to plug it in. I think again, this is one of those cases where this is the best compromise. If you compromised instead by putting it on the back and had that giant ditch cut into it or made it a flat surface, I think people would be like, "Ah, Christ, why is this ugly hole on the..." Sorry, can I curse on the show? Why the hell is this ugly cut on the back? My fingers can't stop finding it. Why is it flat on the back? I try to hit the button, I'm hitting this stupid back plane. So it's like the solution might be worse than what we're complaining about.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a real hard time imagining. You know, I can't reconcile with this. For me, the best analogy I can make is I remember reading when Valve were making Portal 2, and they developed Portal for the sequel to Portal for a long time, and they decided that they wanted to do a different mechanic rather than the Portal gun. And then they had a day where they went, hang on, they just put their heads in their hands and went, look, we're making a Portal sequel without a Portal gun. This is silly. And so they scrapped that and then ended up making what became Portal 2. And to me, I just feel like someone at Apple should have had a moment that said, hang on, we've released a mouse that you cannot use when it's charging. I can't reconcile with it myself.
I'm surprised. I'm actually went the other way. I'm surprised that you can actually charge. The other stuff is just like happenstantial that you can charge them while you're using it, just because they have those massive backplanes they can put stuff on. So like the thing is, like, no matter how much this stuff, and like people are still annoyed by the camera. Like I am too. The camera bump on the back of the iPhone.
That was the other point on my list.
No matter how much we're annoyed by them, can you imagine how much the industrial design team is annoyed by them? I mean, they spent years trying to work. They hate this stuff more than anybody. But the thing is, we live in a world where physics dictates that you have a Z index for cameras, and that if you flatten them beyond a certain, like you just cannot fit those kinds of optics in a small enough Z index. So you've got to make it higher. And then like, well, I'll make the whole phone higher and fill it up with battery. Well, battery's not frosting. You can't just pump it in. Battery geometry doesn't work that way. Plus, it's a thermal insulator and it's not radio transparent. And there's international laws about shipping the stuff when it gets to certain cell densities. So it doesn't work that way. So the best worst compromise is putting a bump on the camera. Then you get a good camera and a light. Because people get confused about like the thickness of a phone. They think Apple is obsessed with thinness, where they really don't care about the thinness. They care about the lightness, because lightness is usability. And if you ever try to hold up a – like I have a Nokia here. Like if you ever try to hold up – and I have heavier phones too. Forget what, an HTC something. When you try to hold them up, you just can't do it for long periods of time, especially big phones. And it sounds great. Like, oh, this Max phone lasts for 2 days, but I don't ever want to pick it up. They emphasize lightness and all this stuff. It's not made thin to be thin. It's made thin to be light. It's like the iPad Pro weighs as much as the original iPad, which is goofy because it's like twice the size. But if it was any heavier, because people are like, fill it up with battery, made it last 2 days. Yes, it would be 3 pounds. And then no one would want to use it.
Yeah.
So it's these things where the charging it that way is a bad compromise, but is a better compromise. Given the ideal solution is to redesign the entire mouse, like just make an entirely new mouse. They didn't have time. They did that with the trackpad. They didn't have time to do that with the mouse this year. We'll get one eventually. But instead of cutting a hole in the front, they decided to put the charger on the back.
Okay. Yeah. And you mentioned the camera bump as well. Okay. So I think I've only got one other thing that I'd touch on my list here. Do you think after WWDC, like the keynote, who owns those keynotes? Do you think, you know, maybe afterwards Tim Cook said, like, come on, Eddie, no, you're not doing that again?
So the keynotes are interesting because it's a marketing driven event, and the reaction was interesting to me because some people really, and I don't understand it personally, some people really believe the music stuff was the best stuff of that keynote, especially people who had musical backgrounds and they liked seeing Drake. They thought it was hip and young, and I thought it was a train wreck. And some people thought that Eddie, you know, and Apple Music, the whole thing was great, and it was my least favorite part of the keynote. So I don't want to substitute. I don't want to say like my taste is universal and that I should be like the barometer for all that stuff. I'm not sure I like this sort of, and this could be me being an incredibly old grandfather, but like, you know, Apple keynotes used to be very, and they weren't serious because Steve Jobs was funny in a way, but they used to be, I don't know what the right word is, but now you got like all these dad jokes. No, focus is the wrong thing, because they had some, like, there are some train wrecks of keynotes in the past. Like, it's all that thing. Like, I know you guys talked about, like, the Steve Jobs, what would happen if Steve was here. And the thing is that there were just as many, Mobile Me was a horrible train wreck, happened under Steve Jobs. iPod Hi-Fi, not a good product, happened under Steve Jobs. All sorts of really goofy things happened at keynotes that Steve Jobs was involved in. So it's just sort of like, you know, like the jokes about OS X Weed and thing, you know, and like the karaoke pictures, yeah. And that stuff gets a reaction.
Makes a lot of sort of lame jokes,
and some people love them. Like, you hear like people erupting with laughter, so then people are like, yes, we're gonna do more of that. But the thing is, you have all these people, and like now Jeff Williams is up on stage because he owns Apple Watch, and he's, you know, he's essentially chief operating officer. He doesn't have the title yet, but he's executive vice president of operations at Apple, and he gets to go and do the keynote if he wants it. So like you have all these different opinions, and you have these incredibly dense product lines. And at the last event, they didn't even mention the Mac. The Mac was in a little email sidebar on the side when OS X Yosemite was the release date for that. It didn't even get a mention in the keynote. So they have all these different things going on. And Tim Cook, I think, does own it, but I don't think – like I think Tim Cook, more than Steve Jobs, is like, I don't think he comes out with gut reactions and just says, I want it this way because I want it this way. I think he's much more data focused, and he believes in getting people's opinions. And I think he lets – and this is just my sense of it. I've got no actual foundation for this, but I get the sense that he lets people run their divisions more than maybe Steve did. Maybe Steve let him run it, but like I think Tim is like, you know, if Eddie wants to do this, that's Eddie's thing to do. You know, unless and until Tim Cook says no, we're not doing that anymore, I don't think anyone else at Apple has the power to do that.
So maybe Steve used veto power more than Cook does.
Oh, I think Steve and Tim have very different areas of expertise. Like, as much as people say the vision for the iPad would never have existed without Steve Jobs, it would never have shipped at $500 without Tim Cook. Like, Tim Cook is a very different CEO than Steve Jobs. I think Steve Jobs was the kind of person who'd be like, no karaoke at this show. But Steve, no. I said, no karaoke. where Tim Cook would be like, he's detail oriented. I'm sure he reads over every line of that thing. But I don't know if he sort of forces his will upon people in that way.
Yeah.
And maybe he does, but then maybe like if he started to take an interest in keynotes, maybe he's not the best keynote guy, right? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's pretty much everything on my list here. Did you have anything else you wanted to mention?
No, and so like again, like I don't want to. I'm trying to give like just a difference of opinion. But the bottom line thing for me is still that yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's broken. There's a lot of stuff that desperately needs to get fixed. I think we know that it's broken and we deserve for it to be fixed. Like I don't want anyone to say that to think that I think that Apple's doing all this great. I think that there's fundamental problems that they need to solve. I don't know that I have the answers for them. And I think as customers, we deserve these things to be solved. I don't think they're easy or trivial to solve. I think there's always limits to resources and attention. And as you know, you're a developer. If you're spending your day working on feature A, it means you're not spending that day working on feature B. And you have to decide which one of those is more important to you. So every time this happens, I'm like, well, what would I give up to have this? And it sounds strange because it's the world's biggest company, right? But like what would I pull like UIKit? I would have them stop doing all this, start doing that. What would I have given up 3D Touch for that? Would I have given up Apple Pencil for something else? And it really is that. It's like money. I can't spend $100 on one thing and on another thing. I have to make these choices. And Apple as a company has to make these choices. And sometimes those choices will be good for me and sometimes they won't. But as a vendor, it is absolutely their job to fix all these things in the best way possible. And I think like shows like this are great. And I think when people blog about problems at Apple, like I think when people get like, they have to have trials, they have to like start throwing solutions around. I think it's less helpful. But I think when people say, this is the problem that I have, I want to make a sustainable app. And instead of saying upgrades are stopping me, blah, like I can't get the conversion. I can't get customers to try it. I can't get upfront pricing on it. I can't, I want to continue development on it, but there's no way for me to get incremental income on it. Whether Marco's talking about like functional, like I have these bugs, I have these problems. I think that's hugely important because that is what people read and that is what influences companies at the end of the day. So as much focused, intelligent complaining as possible, I think is the best thing everybody can do.
Okay, great. Well, Renee, thank you so much for offering up your time and having this discussion. I really appreciated it. Do you want to let everyone know where they can find you online?
I am at Renee Ritchie on Twitter and most of the stuff that I do ends up there.
And you got 50 different podcasts that you're on each week.
Yeah, I try. We've got Debug coming up this week with the return of Don Melton and Nitin Ganatra talking about, what are they talking about this time? Hiring and retention for software development.
Wow, okay. I'll definitely be tuning into that one then. Okay, Renee, thanks again so much. Really appreciate it. And a special shout out to Phil Nickinson for playing matchmaker here and helping me bring you on.
Oh, thanks, Phil.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Blurk. Hopefully, if you got this far, it means you enjoyed the show. A very quick note, creating this podcast does take a meaningful amount of time, and you'll notice there were no advertisements or anything like that in this episode. In lieu of that, I would ask that if you got something out of the episode, if you could see fit to help me out by subscribing and sharing the show with your friends on social media, I'd really appreciate it. Your efforts to help me grow the show is absolutely the best way to ensure that I continue to make more of these episodes going forward. And of course, if you've got an Android device, I'd be very grateful if you'd check out my app, Action Launcher 3, in the Google Play Store, and perhaps buy the in-app upgrade and or leave me a nice review. You don't even need to log in and set your password for that on Google Play. Catch you next time.